Session 11, Being a Family. Today's society, with television and other influences, reduces precious time for family togetherness. Here's what you can do to help your child feel he is a special part of your family.
Throughout this program, we've been talking about the why and how to raise happy and healthy children. And in this session, Brian, let's talk a little bit about the real issue, and that's having the time to really pull together all of the activities that make a family fun and play together and stay together and really work to build a foundation of love and trust and togetherness.
Right. You know, if we take everything we've talked about, the critical issue is time. The critical element is time. Everything that we've said requires a greater time commitment than the average person is even aware that they have to give. In several studies that I've read where parents and their later years have been asked, what is the biggest single regret that you have about being a parent? Almost invariably, probably 98-99%, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers, will say, my biggest single regret is that I didn't spend enough time with my children when they were young.
Or conversely, they say, the greatest joy I've had in my life, throughout my career or careers or throughout all of the work and things that I've done, has been the time that I've taken, the time that I've shared with my children.
Yes, and Michel de Montaigne, the great French essayist, said that the great business of life is to create happy memories. He said the most joyous things we have in life are the happy memories that we can reflect upon, and the great business of life is to create as many of them as possible. And perhaps the happiest memories that a human being can have are those joyous, loving, sort of unbidden moments of happiness that you have when you spend long periods of time with your children.
That's really a wonderful way to look at time, isn't it? That the time that I spend with children is the memory-making that really makes and sustains it over time.
So really the issue in managing family time is the same issue that we have in managing any other kind of time. It's really setting goals. It's determining what our values are. It's setting our priorities. It's organizing our priorities in a hierarchy and then putting first things first.
Brian, that's what I've found to be a real key throughout my lifetime with children raising, and that is that I have always focused on what are my five highest values. And I find I really have to do that in order to keep everything balanced as a one. And that's the way I prioritize. I have to say that my child is as important as work, my work is as important as my traveling, and so on. And I have found that if I say, each year of my child's life, this is the year that my child is six. I only have 1 year in my life to see this young girl be five. I only have 1 year in my life to see this girl be nine, or 1 year to see this girl be 16. I do that with my husband, too. I say I only have 1 year to see this man be 40 or 42. I find that if I put this priority in front of me as a value, then I'm more likely to say, look, you know, life is going on here very rapidly, and you have a very short time to watch childhood, because childhood is very fleeting. You know, you and I have been talking about our children a lot in this program, and my daughter is 16, and I remember when she was 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, and it didn't seem like very long ago. And I'm very aware that I have just a few years yet of childhood. And so I think if we can say to parents to prioritize and to make sure that children are in that priority, it helps us find the time, make the time, really to take the time to make our children's lives important now.
Yes, the great challenge in America today amongst couples, especially working couples, parents, is what has come to be characterized as time poverty. They say that today we are not short of money so much as we are short of time. And every single study seems to indicate that people would rather give up money. Sometimes they will take even a lower income if they can have more time to spend with their families. However, this is idealistic because their boss is not going to give them the choice, and their responsibilities, what they have to get done, are going to increase rather than decrease. So we come to the basic core of effective time management when we're talking about the family, and that is getting blocks of time. Organizing your time, planning your time, structuring your time so that you can carve off useful chunks of time of minimum 90-minute, 2-hour, 3-hour periods. And that really is the challenge of parenting, is to structure and organize everything from the beginning of the year, the month, the week, the day forward, so that you can carve off those chunks of time that are absolutely essential to raising your children with the character and the personality that you want them to have.
I'm going to come back to this prioritizing, Brian, because we can't really make more time. All we can do is manage the time we have. And if we look at time as a very valuable resource, it is our most precious gift. What do lovers give to one another most? It is time. What do we give to one another but the time? If I put you on hold on the phone, you know, what am I wasting? Time. We tell one another a lot about their importance to us by the time they are willing to spend or to take with us. And likewise, we send that message to our children. We've been talking about children's points of view in this program a lot. And children equate our loving them with the amounts of time that we spend with them.
Yes, and it's not quality of time, as some of the so-called experts say. Our children only measure quantity. Our children really look at the number of minutes. Let me give you an example. My little boy asks me every so often if he can have a special day with me. He's 7 years old. He's been doing this since he was five. And whenever he asks me, I say, all right, we'll set up and we'll schedule it. And sometimes I'll take him on a motor trip with me when I'm driving to another city. Sometimes I'll even take him on an airplane. Or I'll just take him in town and I'll take him out of school for the afternoon and we'll have a special day. And what we do is we go to McDonald's and maybe we go to a toy store or we go for a walk or I take him to my office. But it's just one-on-one time that he has with me. Whenever this occurs, Christina, who's a little bit older, wants to know exactly how much time I spent with Michael. She wants to know to the minute, and then she wants her exact fair share. In fact, she wants more because she's older. And she measures from the time we start our special time together with Christina, she measures how much time it is, and she's very insistent. Quantity of time, not what you do or where you go so much, but quantity of time is her measure, but quantity of time is also Michael's measure, and now quantity of time is becoming David's measure. He's learning it from them.
You know, I'm often surprised at parents' response when they say to me, my child is acting up. What should I do? Give me just two or three real fast. What can I do? And the first thing I always say is, spend more time with your child. And they look at me as though I haven't said anything very profound. But yet there is a correlation between the time we spend with our children and their behavior. One of the things that's very helpful to me is if I'm in a project that's requiring intense time over a period of time, if I'm writing or something like that, I'll bring that project right to the dinner table after dinner and bring my daughter and let her sit down and start homework right there with me. And she does not see that as mom being busy. She sees that as together time.
If you want a way to transform your relationship with your child, at any time that you're having difficulties with your child, here's a tip. Go home. Tell the child, put on your walking shoes or your running shoes, let's go for a walk together. And then just plan a walk that takes enough space or distance into consideration that you have to walk for at least an hour. I will promise you, you'll come back from that walk with such a transformation in your relationship, it will astonish you at the power of that sustained 1 hour where you walk and talk and interchange and exchange. Now, the first 10 or 20 or 30 minutes may be strained. It may be broken. It may be uneasy. There may be things to clear up. But you'll find in the last half hour of that walk, things start to flow and you start to exchange and you start to be honest with each other. Just absolutely remarkable to take that time.
Let's talk about some of those creative ways that we find time with children. I think that would be helpful for parents who are very busy.
Okay, we created a program for adults recently, and it's called How to Master Your Time. And the program starts off with what we call the psychology of time management. And I think that's where you should really start it here, the psychology of family time. And the psychology of family time begins with how you think about family time. I used to, when I was younger and less experienced, I used to think that family time was taken away from other things until I turned my thinking around and realized that other things are taken away from family time. If you start with that, you ask this question. You say, what's important here? If I only had 6 months to live, how would I spend that 6 months? And you will find that the answer will invariably be that you would spend that time with your family. So therefore, say to yourself, do I have to be under a threat of death or imminent demise in order to spend the amount of time that I should be spending with my family? The answer is no. And so by thinking it through, you realize that your highest value, your most important priority is quality and quantity time with your family, and everything else is secondary to that. Then you start to organize your time properly.
One of the things I do right along that line is I take out, and I usually plan on a monthly basis. I'll take out my calendar and I'll say to my daughter, let's look at what we've got going this month. What are the activities you want mom to be a part of this month? Do you have particular games? Do you have particular activities? Do you have particular ceremonies at school you want me there for? Do you have particular things you want done? And so she looks, and she looks at my calendar that's open, and she sees me schedule her in. And it's like this real aha experience for her. And then all of a sudden in her mind, there is this priority that she comes first. And then if there are events that are really important to her, I won't change them. I won't schedule something else there.
As you said a little while ago, it's very important that the only way you can get time is by taking time away from other things. So the starting point of getting chunks of time and consolidating those chunks of time so that they are valuable to your children is to start thinking about what is called the law of the excluded alternative. What are you going to exclude or delete or reject or stop doing in order to have more of the time to spend with your children? And I would like to suggest that the starting point in many homes would be to stop the newspaper. Stop reading the newspaper as much as people do. It's absolutely amazing how many hours per day are spent reading the newspaper. The Newspaper Guild of America reckons that the average adult will read the average newspaper from front to back and read every single page and spend as much as 2 and sometimes 3 hours per day reading the paper. The average father will very often read the sports page from front to back and spend as much as 1 hour to 90 minutes just reading the sports page every day. And these are the same people that say, I am too busy to go for a walk. I don't know where I'm going to get the time. I'm under such tremendous time pressures. My recommendation is read the newspaper not more than 10 or 15 minutes a day. Read only headlines, and if possible, stop reading it altogether. Many people in my seminars have come up and said, well, how can you recommend that? I say, it's easy. They say, well, how will you know what's going on? I say, don't worry. If it's important, somebody will tell you. And I've had countless people come back to me over the years who said, you know, I quit reading the newspaper as a result of your recommendation, and you're absolutely right that if it was at all important, somebody else would come and tell me in 25 words or less and would save me hours of reading the same stories.
I find that one of the biggest intrusions in our home was the television, that it sapped up a lot of time. It didn't add to quality family time. It didn't add to the information or the joy that children were experiencing there. And so without that television, you glean back a lot of together time. And if you're not together, I find that if my daughter is doing homework and off in a corner and my husband is doing something and I'm in another room, it still lends itself to just downtime where you feel like you have some time for yourself. Because I hear both adults and children say, I wish I had more time for me. I wish I had more down, alone, quiet time. And just stopping the television really gives us back some of that time.
You know, an interesting study showed that families that are very together are very different from families that aren't by the place that the television is located in the house. You see, television is a tool, and it's a useful and practical tool that brings marvelous information and entertainment into our home. So we don't recommend that you scrap the television. But they found that families that are really together have the television in a television room, a separate room, a room that you have to go to watch it. The families that have very little communication have the television as the centerpiece in the main room in the house. So it's always on. In the room where the family should be talking and communicating together, the television sits in the middle and is the main piece of furniture and is always going. So the very act, and I bought a home some years ago and decided not to have the television in the living room, and I put it downstairs in a basement room. And the whole quality of our home life was different because if you wanted to watch the television, you had to leave the family, you had to go downstairs, you had to turn on the lights, you had to make a real effort to go to where the television was to watch it. And in most cases, you just stopped doing it.
In our home, too, we've put a bigger emphasis on just physical fitness. And we've found that to be a real important time together where everyone can walk or play or just be outdoors, that physical activities for us have been a real uniting area.
I was listening to a gentleman speak who lectures on family relations and togetherness and communications. And he was talking about how he took his son out of school one day. His son was 15 years old. To go skiing, and they had to drive 3 hours to a ski resort. He said on those 3 hours, he learned more about his son than he had learned in the previous 5 years. He said he had no idea what his son was thinking, what his concerns were, what his worries were, what he was interested in, what he was excited about, and so on. He was out traveling around the country lecturing to people on how to have better family relations. And it was only when he took that car trip and spent three long, uninterrupted hours with his son that he realized that he had stopped having the communications he was recommending that others have. So one recommendation I would give to parents is to schedule motor trips, not for the sake of the destination, but for the sake of the journey. Because sometimes in two or three hours of driving with a family together in a car with the radio off, the tapes off, just talking, more will come out and be resolved. More and better and deeper communications will be established. You'll get more of a sense of being a family unit than in almost any other environment.
Brian, I'd like to point out just one area there. While families come together and have time together to be cohesive and to sense one another as a family, just as important is to spend the alone time with each child, and you were talking about that a little bit earlier. But it's important because children then get a sense to not compete with one another for your time, but to see themselves alone. Earlier we were talking about Craig Frazier in the book Burnt and his entry into drugs and his long haul back. And it wasn't until his father took him on a business trip with him that lasted several days. And his father made a comment. He said, "I learned more about my son in those days together." And he said, "We were in another country, so we really had to depend on one another." And he said, "I found that placing myself in a situation where my son and I had to really bond and be cohesive to make it was a real entry into knowing my son." And that's good advice, to just be alone, spend some alone time. One parent with one child. You know, sometimes if my husband and I go someplace with my daughter, we get busy being a threesome, and that's important. But knowing my child very, very well requires that I spend some alone time with her.
Yes, and lots of time that just drifts past with no pressure to do something or say something, just allowing the time to unfold. If you pick up the child and rush from spot A to spot B to do something and then to spot C and D and so on and then come home again, it doesn't have the same effect as if you have that all the time in the world attitude when you're spending this quantity of time with your children.
There's a lot of research on type A personalities, and we find that always being in a hurry, always being in a rush, always living a hurried lifestyle is very detrimental to our children. So when we talk about time, we might also think about our modeling, what we're teaching children by how we manage time.
Yes, and when the child comes and they want to talk or they seem to be concerned about something, it's very important that we stop. And I mentioned earlier that whenever my children came to me when I'm reading, and whenever they come to me when I'm reading, I stop what I'm reading. I immediately ask what's important here, and I put it all aside so that they can see that I've stopped and that my attention is solely on them. Another thing that we do with our family, and our children have introduced us to this, is we go to family movies together. Our children just love to go to a movie. And sometimes they don't even enjoy the movie. Sometimes they fidget. Sometimes they run out and buy candy or go to the bathroom and come back and so on. But when we say in the following week, "Would you like to go to a movie this weekend?" they all want to go to the movie because to them that's a total family experience. And on the way to the movie, you talk about what you think is going to be in it. On the way back from the movie, you talk about the parts that they enjoyed. And we use this as a springboard. We ask our children, "What did you like best about the movie? How would you compare that movie with another movie? What was your favorite movie? Why was that your favorite movie? Why did you like it when that happened?" And children get a chance to think about the experience and to think about the moral lessons. They think about the acts of heroism. They think about the acts of kindness that they saw in the picture. They get a chance to express it, and they get excited about it. So the whole experience is you might say, delicious for a child to be able to go to a movie with their parents, because it's sort of like a multimedia, multidimensional experience. And it takes very little time. You make it a family ritual on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon, and it's amazing what a bonding influence this has on a family.
With regard to time, Brian, an important hallmark of time in a family is that it does build self-esteem. That's really the essence of spending time with children, of making them feel important, of giving them your time and attention. And one of the things that we do in counseling sessions with families is to take out the photo album and to always have in your home photo albums of children over time so that they can see time, because children have a very narrow definition of time. They see today, and they have some aspirations about tomorrow, but that's about it. And anything that bad happened yesterday, they remember. But the family photo album is a very important ingredient in how a child sees time and remembers the time that you have spent with them. So always have photo albums that are rich in family activities, things that have happened together, things that have been a part of your lives together, and leave those out and leave them open and make sure that children go through them now and then.
Oh, and it's amazing. Children love to go through the photo albums that track their history. Our children once a month take out our wedding pictures and look at our wedding pictures. And sometimes they say, "Where were we?" And we say that you weren't here yet. And then they take out other albums and they go through them and they look at them and they sort of stare at them reflectively. They sort of bask in looking at pictures of themselves when they were younger. Every so often, Christina will see a new baby. And she's 9. And she'll say, "Daddy," she'll say, "was I a cute baby?" And of course, she knows that she was because we've told her before. And we'll say, "Yes, you were a very cute baby." And then she'll say, "What did they call me when I was a baby?" Well, in the hospital, the nurses called her Peanut. That was her nickname, Peanut, because she looked like a little peanut. And they thought she was the cutest little baby that had been born that day or that time. So she always asks us, "What did the nurses call me when I was in the hospital? Was I a cute baby?" And she likes to be told the same things over and over again. Then she likes to go and look at the pictures of her when she was a baby, when she was called Peanut. And it's a very important part of her sense of identity that she has this history that goes back those many years.
And something else that you can do right along that line is to build for your children your own sense of childhood. Talk to them about you when you were a child and you when you were a preteen and a teenager and a young adult and so on, because it gives children a sense of themselves. They often look at you and they want to know, or they think, "What will I look like when I'm an adult?" And so talking a lot about yourself is not only a way to share yourself, but to give children a sense of time. One of the things that I did for my daughter many years ago, and I didn't know how well it would serve her, was she kept asking the question, "What will I look like when I'm a teenager? What will I look like when I'm older? You know, will I always have this, or will I always look like this?" And I took photos of myself for each grade level. You know, my mother had saved photos, and I put them in a picture and framed them for her of each year. And, of course, the pictures changed dramatically from year to year. And she was able to see herself over time. And then I took the photos of herself from infancy through age 10 and put them in a frame. But it was a very important space and time concept for her. And that gives children a sense of themselves and time, really an essence of time.
And I find my children are fascinated by stories about my mother and father. So I'll say, "You know, when I was your age, my father said this, or my father did this, or when I was about 10 years old, this is what my mother did, or this is what we did as a family." And I will tell them both positive experiences and negative experiences. Sometimes I will have an argument with them, and I'll say, "You know, when I was younger, this is what happened to me, and I didn't want it to happen to you, because my father or my mother didn't know that that would hurt your feelings or that this would be the consequences of it. And so I know now, and I made a decision that I wasn't going to do to you or have this happen to you what happened to me." And so they'll ask me questions. "Well, what was it like? Or what was your father like? Or what was your mother like?" And then they'll want to know about grandparents. And then they want to know about uncles and aunts. And where were they at this time? And so on. And one of the reasons why children get into trouble or feel low self-esteem or get attracted to drugs or perform poorly is a sense of isolation and detachment, what we call a sense of being a member of the nuclear family, that there is no sense of history, there's no past and present. But the more children have a sense of being part of a process of history, that they're part of generations, that they go back to parents and grandparents and uncles and aunts and brothers that came over years before or lived in different places, the more they have this sense of history behind them, the stronger is their sense of identity.
Brian, in all of your research on time management, you've done a number of programs on time management. What two or three pieces of advice would you give parents?
Well, I would say the first one, and that's a great question, is that, as we said earlier, start off the year by planning your family time, saying, "We're going to take this weekend, we're going to take this week, we're going to take these days." And instead of saying, "Well, I'm going to catch up with all the time I haven't spent with my family on Sunday, or I'm going to catch up with it all on summer vacation," what you do is you plan your vacations and then you work your work around the vacations. Then you plan your months, just as you suggested a little bit earlier, and you lay out your month and you say, "All right, where are we going to spend time with our family during this month?" And then you plan your week, and then you plan your days. And you make sure that every day, every week, every month, you spend the time that you've committed with them as your highest priority. There's a natural tendency for us. We say, you know, I am going to start reading 30 to 60 minutes a day. And then on Monday we're too busy, so we'll do it on Tuesday. We'll do an hour and a half to 2 hours. But Tuesday we're too busy, so we'll read all evening Wednesday. Well, Wednesday we're so busy, well, we'll do the whole night Thursday. Thursday we're so busy, we say, well, I'll save it till Sunday, and I'll read all day Sunday. Sunday comes, and we don't do it at all. And we know over and over again that processes of time like this have to be done incrementally. We have to spend the time each day. And Stephen Covey has a wonderful example where he says, imagine if a farmer kept procrastinating on planting his crop. And he kept procrastinating in March, and he procrastinated in April, and he procrastinated in May, and June, and July, and August, and then he rushed out and he wanted to put it all in the ground in September and get the harvest. Well, we know that that would be ridiculous. However, we expect to develop a high-quality relationship with our children, and therefore high-quality children, by continually delaying spending the concentrations of time that are necessary, thinking that we can catch them all up on a family vacation or we can catch them all up in the summertime. The fact is that it just doesn't work like that. It's got to be day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month.
And I think that's a real part of what we're seeing with this destructive behavior in young people is that they don't have enough time from us. They're not sensing enough time. They're not sensing a priority in our life. And it mirrors back. And I believe that it's easier to take the time than to catch up that time or to try to find it.
You never do catch up the time because of time poverty. We just don't have the time to catch up in unless we do it incrementally day by day.
Right, and children are very resentful of the time we don't spend with them, and they become angry and hostile, and they get back at us.
Yes, I travel a lot as a speaker, and I will not forget something happened just a little while ago. I was come back from a trip of 3 or 4 days, and I feel that my children are pretty well adjusted to my traveling. Barbara takes wonderful care of them. Anyway, Barbara said, you know, the kids have been acting up because you've been gone for 4 days this time. And I said, well, geez, I'll check on that. I mean, I'll do some perception checking. So I said to Christina casually the next morning, who's just having breakfast, I said, Christina, what do you think about the amount of time that I spend traveling? I don't like it, she said. There was that little time between the question and the answer. It's, I don't like it immediately. And I just realized or had reinforced again how sensitive they are to the amount of time that you spend with them.
Brian, an important part of that then is to help our children stay connected to us. I know what I do when I travel is that I always leave a phone number so that my daughter can reach me at any time. And many times she doesn't call, but it gives her the perception that the link between us has not been broken. And so staying connected, however you do that, whether it's a note or whether it's letters if you're going to be separated for some time. I know that I deal with many parents who are separated or divorced, and they live thousands of miles away from their child. And in frustration, they stop connecting. They feel that they aren't making a big connection, that they aren't influencing their child, or they're lonely, or they miss the child, and they are afraid that by connecting, those feelings will come through and that might be harmful to the child. They don't want the child to miss them and that kind of thing. And so they'll not connect. Yet it is that writing, that calling, that linking that becomes an important measure for the child. So connecting is an important one. A second thing that I do quite a bit in that is I take my child to work with me now and then, or I have her come to my workplace after school. So it gives her, again, that link, not only into my life and my world, but a way for us to be together. I know that's not a possibility for many parents, but just having your child be a part of you, if you go in on the weekends, take your child with you if you can. Help your child understand what you do and why you do what you do. That's an important link to how connected they are in the time that you're away from them, how they will value that time.
Yes, and another thing is that we have a natural tendency to talk about the people at work, our bosses, our subordinates, our coworkers at home. And it's really great when kids know who you're talking about. They have met these people, they've been in your office, they've been in their office, and so they feel, again, this connectedness. They feel that they are part of a total process. One of the things that we do with our children, because our children are younger, is we read to them, and we have them read to us. And we find that even though they resist it a little bit initially, when we turn off the television, they'll say we want to watch television because, of course, it's the expedient thing to do. But we say, no, we're going to read. So then they'll immediately run, and each of them will go and get a book. And then we will read each of their books one after another. And they calculate or reckon this to be some of the most important time that they spend with us. They just love. They sit all together and they listen attentively. They just love to be read to. And then as they learn to read, they just love to read to their parents and have their parents listen attentively to them.
You know, Brian, right along that line, many years ago I started a story with my daughter on her birthday where I would read into a tape a little bit about her life that year. And I did it for fun for a couple of years in a row. And it's something she will not let me back off on. Every year this becomes an important part. She goes and gets the tape now. And she'll put in a cassette and she wants to see this year in review. And she has this little library. And this is important. And you see, again, it's that measure of time and its connectingness.
Oh, that's great. And, of course, with movie cameras the way they are today, you can make a movie cassette of your child's high points each year, taking the cassette in and out during the course of the year and just taping the child, videotaping the child, and putting that away once a year so the children can go back years later and they can get a retrospective of their whole year.
Oh, it's a marvelous technology for families.
One of the things we do, too, in the car and also at home, which has been wonderfully helpful for us, is we talk to our children about themselves, and we also talk amongst ourselves, Barbara and I, about our children in their presence. And I must have read this technique in a book on effective parenting years ago because it was such a wonderful idea. So we'll say, you know, Christina, you certainly are a wonderful girl. You're so helpful around the house. And we'll say to Michael, I said, Michael, you're a great guy. You're really good at cleaning up your room. You keep your room clean. And we talk to David. Now, David is pretty aggressive, but I call him Dave the Brave because I know that if you impute a quality to a child long enough and hard enough, the child begins to believe that he or she is that expression. Now, David has started coming up to me and saying, "Hi, Daddy, I'm Dave the Brave." And now he likes to be called Dutical Dave the Brave. Dutical is the word today. It means radical or hip. He likes to be called Dutical Dave the Brave, and that's his full name, and it has an effect on his personality. When we drive along, sometimes Barbara and I will say, you know, we sure have wonderful children. We have the most wonderful kids in the world. And I can assure you that the only time our children sit quietly in the back seat of the car is when Barbara and I are sitting in the front seat talking about them as though they weren't there. And it really is good for them. It really enhances and reinforces their self-esteem to hear their parents speak about them so favorably.
Another thing that's really positive for children is to have other adults come back and talk about events that you've talked with them about. If I say to you, for example, Jennifer just had a softball game and she, you know, played this or she did that, and you come back and say, "Hey, I hear you had a pretty good game." It's a real positive reinforcement for her because it shows, again, connection and bonding and her importance to me.
Yes, I think we could probably wrap this session by saying that with regard to managing family time, nothing is more important in your role as a parent. Everything that we've talked about, from self-esteem building, positive encouragement and expectations, setting goals, developing love and warmth and support, everything requires that one indispensable element, time. And if you will make the time and invest the time in your children, the payoff will be extraordinary.
Session 12, Raising Super Kids. Every parent's dream is to raise children who are healthy, happy, loving, confident, and able to succeed in the world. Betty and Brian share 21 ideas you can apply immediately to raise children who are capable of meeting the world head on.
Betty, you know, I'm a businessman, and I have always been attracted to practical, simple, usable techniques, methods, and ideas. And in this final session on how to raise super kids, why don't we just go back and forth and give the parents that are listening a whole series of practical things that they can do right now to get a result, to make their kids feel terrific, to perform better, to be happier, and to achieve the goal of this program to raise happy, healthy, self-confident young people. And let me start off with what I think should be the first one, and that each parent right now should make a decision to do whatever is necessary to be an excellent parent. Make the decision to pay any price, to spend any amount of time, to do any amount of research, to go to any number of meetings, classes, courses, listen to tapes, read books, and so on, to become a really, really wonderful parent. It's never too late to be an excellent parent, and it's always a never-ending job. You never ends, but it starts off with the decision that I'm going to be a terrific parent. I'm going to be everything my children could possibly want of me.
I'm going to add a challenge on that one, Brian, to parents, and that would be that they start by deciding what their philosophy is, because it's a guiding line so that they really can follow through with that. I think great intentions are certainly the starting point, but so oftentimes in our busy lives, they become just that, intentions that never quite get done. And so I'd like to challenge parents by starting off by thinking about what is their mission, what do they want to teach and be for their children. And then secondly, to develop that mission, that family mission statement that we talked about earlier, Brian, and to put it in a place where they can see it often, and to put it in the place where they look most often, so that right in front of them, there is a model for them to be intentional about being there for their children and about their children's priority in their life.
Constantly reaffirm to our children that children are the most important to us, that our family is important, that raising them to be happy and healthy and self-confident is our top priority, and that everything else takes second place to our children and to the health and happiness of our family, and then live that every single day.
That's right, Brian. And another area would be to praise our children and to know that praise brings about good behavior, it brings about high performance, it brings about the best of our children, and it is the linking bond to that parent-child relationship.
Yes, and one of the definitions of self-esteem is the degree to which a person feels praiseworthy or worthy of praise. And the only way a child knows if they're praiseworthy is if they get praised by the most important person in their life. In fact, ergonomic studies on tired children have demonstrated that children who are praised sincerely by an authority figure actually have surges of physical energy. They actually brighten up and have more energy and are capable of carrying on longer, working longer, traveling longer, and so on. The effect of praise is just wonderful on the personality of young people.
Right, and it's also the starting point of high expectations. Praising sets in motion expectations for the child to live up to, and in many cases becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, and as the one-minute manager says, catch your children doing something right.
As opposed to zapping them when they're...
That's right. Give them one-minute praising. Catch them doing something right.
Another thing, Brian, is that it's really important to tell your children every day that you love them. And it's not so much that you say, I love you, but that you make statements that show the importance of them to you. I say to my daughter quite often, and in a meaningful way, otherwise I don't say it because you don't want it just to be a tired phrase, you're so important to me, Jennifer, or have a great day, you know, I wish you the best today. Setting in motion again the fact that she's important to me.
My little David goes around saying, Daddy, I love you so much. Or he says, Mommy, I love you so much. And each time he does that, we hug him and we say, I love you so much too. And he walks around saying, I love you so much. And he just beams, because saying the words, I love you, makes a person feel terrific. When I was raised, my father never said, I love you, in all the time he lived. And it was because of his childhood and his relationship with his father that he was brought up to feel that that was just simply not something that you did. So I had to overcome the fact that it was not part of my upbringing to express love to my children that often and that openly. And I had to practice. And I only mention this on this tape is because a lot of parents will find that if they practice just a little bit, not only will they get wonderful reinforcement from their children, but every time you say, I love you, it becomes easier to say it again. And you can never say, I love you, too often to your children. And if you think it's possible, wait until they tell you to stop telling you.
That's right. And I think a challenge, Brian, is that as our children grow and get older, as they move from one stage to another, we have to keep finding ways to say to our children, I love you, you mean everything to me. Because there are times in children's lives where if they don't feel lovable or if they don't believe you're sincere, they discount it. And in fact, it becomes a negative. So to keep looking for the ways to show your child that you care, that you love, and to know that they feel it.
Do you know a wonderful thing that many parents do is they put a little love note in their lunchbox, or they'll put a little love note under their pillow so that the child will find it unexpectedly and it will just say, I love you very much, have a great day, signed Mom, or you're very important to me, signed Dad. And those little notes for your children just cause them to feel tremendous. Sometimes it brings tears to their eyes, and it only takes a second, but the impact on it is lasting, and your children save those notes. And sometimes they'll have those notes 20 or 30 years from now, just a little kindness that you took the time to write before they went off.
And then the good news is, Brian, that they start giving those praises back to you. It's when your child will turn around and do something for you that you know you're reaching home.
Yeah.
I came home and had a very positive experience on a recent trip, and my daughter had written on my mirror, where I would see it first thing in soap, a little message about the success of that. And so when I saw that, immediately I knew that what she had learned was from the notes over the years that I had left in her pockets or in her lunchbox. She was now feeding them back. And, of course, that's a great connection.
The payoff is tremendous. A final point of telling your children you love them every day is, if you're away, phone them and say, I love you. Even if it only takes 30 seconds, phone and say, I just wanted to tell you that I love you. And it's amazing how much more connected children feel when they just have a couple of words with their parent when the parent's away.
Brian, another really important measure here is that when you connect with your child, when your child walks into your presence, they walk into your workplace or they walk into the study or you walk into the room where they are, the moment you see them smile, let your eyes dance and let your smile show. It shows right away the value of that child to you.
Yes, smiling lovingly at your child is considered one of the most powerful ways to fill what Dr. Ross Campbell calls their emotional tanks. You see, most parents do not look directly in a focused way at their children except when they're scolding or when they're angry or when they're upset. But if you take the time when the child comes into your presence to swing your eyes like a searchlight and just focus the searchlight with a smile of love, almost like you're trying to warm the child with the love, and stop doing whatever you're doing, it's amazing. It actually hits the child. The child drinks in the love through their eyes. And it affects them emotionally and consciously and subconsciously all at once. And you'll see them almost stop sometimes, as if they're almost hit by this wall of love. And they just beam inside. They just feel wonderful about themselves. And it costs you nothing but that extra few seconds to look up and smile and pour your love at them through your eyes.
That's right, and it affects their performance. I think about when a child looks up from a game, you know, and spots their parent in the audience or spots their parents over there in the bleachers, and all of a sudden this child is just filled with this surge of energy, and they start a whole different performance.
Yes, my little boy was in a Halloween parade at his school a little while ago, and I went and I was trying to get his attention. He's 3 years old. He's very small. He's sort of walking along as though he's isolated in his little costume. And so I'd jump up and down, and I'd say, Dave, 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 yay. And I'd finally get his attention, and I'd smile at him, I'd wave at him, and his whole face would brighten up at his father acting like an idiot in the crowd with all of these other parents. And as this little parade went around two or three times, I did it each time. And each time he just beamed and opened up like a sunrise, because children really, really need to be acknowledged and recognized by their parents.
Something else that's really important is to ask children how they're feeling. How are you doing? How are you feeling today? It shows them that we care and that their feelings are important.
Yes, every morning when my children get up, the very first thing I do when I see them is I go to them and I hug them. And I say, how are you this morning? How are you feeling? Did you have a good sleep? And when I come home in the evening, first thing I do, family ritual, is I go and I hug them. I say, did you have a good day? How are you doing? So I always ask them that. And it's amazing how good they feel when you do that. It costs you nothing. It takes very little time. But it really signifies that I think you're really important to me.
One of the things that I do with my daughter, Jennifer, is that when she's not feeling well, she'll want to talk herself out of going to school. And maybe I'll want her to get a sense of how she's feeling, but then to see if she's capable of managing the day. And so rather than to judge how well she is, I'll just listen to her and, you know, touch her and ask her how she's doing, and then let her talk herself into it. And she'll oftentimes come back to the, well, I can manage school. I let that be her decision. But what she's gaining here is that I believe that she's valuable, important enough to make this decision. And so oftentimes she'll take the responsibility for making the correct decision.
Another recommendation is to listen to your children like you really care. When your child starts to speak to you, stop what you're doing as though it were your boss, as though it were somebody that you owed money to, as though it were somebody that had authority over you. When your child needs and wants to express themselves to you, just stop and listen as though there's nothing more important in the world than for them to get out their thought and express it to you.
You know, I sometimes think about how we treat other people. We sometimes listen to strangers or someone on the phone or someone at the door with more seriousness than we do our child.
Yes, and our children are very sensitive to that. In fact, we said it earlier and we should say it again, is that always treat your children the very best that you treat anybody. And here's something else that I do, because I have smaller children, is I get down to their level. if my little boy is three, I get down on the floor so he can communicate with me at eye level, or I will stand him up on the counter so he's standing and his face and my face are at eye level. And with David or Michael or Christina, in each case, I'll adjust myself or help adjust them so that we're speaking eye to eye rather than me speaking down to them. And it's amazing how much better the communication is and how much better they feel, how much more they smile, how much happier they are when we're eye to eye rather than above and below.
Well, of course, being listened to is a very primal need. It's a very basic need to be heard, and to be able to express yourself without having somebody interrupt or make judgment calls is also a link to our overall health, Brian, and especially for children.
Another thing that parents can do to make their children feel terrific, or to raise super kids, if you like, is to ask them for their opinions. Ask them for what they think. Ask them for how they feel on work or on life or on family matters. Ask them what their opinion is of something that's on television. And one of the things that I do is every so often I'll explain to them a problem or a challenge that I'm facing at work, and I'll say, what would you do in a situation like this? Now, it may seem silly to ask a 7-year-old a question about work or business, but it's amazing how much they can contribute from a very naive, a totally unaffected viewpoint. Sometimes they'll come up with insights that will amaze you. But the important thing is that they feel that their opinion is being solicited and their opinion is being respected. That's terribly important for their self-esteem.
Well, it's also a good way to help them learn how to solve problems. One of the things that I have found over the years that's important in solving problems for children is to take a problem that they're having, let's say it's a friendship problem, and to pose the same problem but only in your workplace or your life, and to ask them to solve it. And they can very easily. I mean, they have very clear insight. And then to take that and help them apply it to their situation. And it's a whole different slant on how they see it.
Yes. And as we know from our work in corporations, the more a child can contribute his or her opinion to any decision, the more committed the child will be to go along with the decision once it's made, even if it's not made in favor of the child. But as long as the child has had a chance to voice their opinion and to give their choice and say, this is what I wanted, then if the parent decides this is what we're going to do, the child feels that the decision is partially his or her, and they're more committed to it.
We talked just for a second about problem solving, and I would say that right along that lines, teaching children how to solve problems becomes a really important framework for them feeling like they're capable and competent. I know we use a 4-question approach, and I think it's really helpful. We say, what is the problem? And you're teaching the child, can I identify the real problem here? And secondly, what am I going to do about it? And that's the part where you teach a child to generate alternatives. And thirdly, what's my plan? What am I going to do? And the last part is what we were talking about now, and that's committing to it. Will I really follow through? And that's a part of how children see their capability, and that's a part of how children learn competence.
Yes, and telling children over and over again till they get it at a subconscious level that there's no problem that you can't solve, that there's always a solution to any problem, that if we look at this, if we work on it, if we think about it, we'll find a solution. One of the things that young people need to know is that their world is amenable to solutions, is that they have a sense of control over their destinies. And if a child can grow up with the mindset that no matter what problem I face, I know that I can find a solution, it's certainly vastly superior to this mindset that there's not much you can do, you can't fight City Hall, that you're small, you're inefficacious, you're incompetent, as opposed to I can do it. I know I can find a solution. And those are the kids that become super achievers.
Well, it's this feeling of capability that lends itself to achievement, to achieving things, to accomplishing. And that's another area, Brian, and that is to help children feel that they can accomplish and then to point out their achievements over and over, to help them feel really good about those achievements.
Yes, and say over and over, you can do it. You can do it. You can do anything you put your mind to.
Right, developing that can-do attitude.
Absolutely. And a way to reinforce that can-do attitude is to celebrate their accomplishments. Remember that in order for a child to feel successful, they must first of all overcome difficulty and achieve a goal that they have set or has been set for them, and then they must be recognized by somebody important to them in order for the successful feeling to be experienced. And one of the best ways is to celebrate successes. It doesn't even have to be big things. It can be a small thing. There's a famous story of a large corporation that had a major, major challenge that threatened the success of the company, and all of the top people worked 15, 16, 18 hours a day for 6 months to come up with a totally new process that enabled them to turn the company around. And when the process was complete and they realized they had succeeded, there was a tremendous cheer in the company, and it had all been headed up by one engineer who had accomplished a superhuman task. And the president came in and wanted to give him something to recognize it, but it was 4 o'clock in the morning and they were all exhausted. The only thing he could find in the company refrigerator was a banana. And he went and he looked in the refrigerator, he got the banana, and in front of everybody, he gave him what he called the Top Banana Award. And from that time to this, many years ago, the most prestigious prize of recognition in that corporation is a banana. Now they have it as a trophy, a bronze banana, or a copper banana, or a silver banana. But a banana is now the symbol of triumph in that company. So it doesn't matter what you give them. It's just what matters is that you celebrate their success with something. Taking your kids to McDonald's or giving them a big lollipop or something to celebrate that locks in that feeling of winning.
Well, it's also like a very creative way to use that opportunity. I know when Tom Peters wrote In Search of Excellence, he looked at the top 10 characteristics of successful companies, and recognizing achievement and then praising it was a very important characteristic. And you're right, parents sometimes have to look for ways to recognize achievement, but always should praise it. And that, more than anything else, Brian, leads to more achievement. We get what we call a success cycle, where children will set in motion achieving and wanting to excel and do better. What emerges from that is something we call in our clinical psychology internal motivation. I mean, it is the framework for your child being motivated, wanting to do things, driven by his own motivation to go forward, to achieve, to accomplish. And then, of course, our goal is to make sure that those things that children are working toward are purposeful.
Yes. And, of course, the simplest of all motivational theories is positive reinforcement. You continually reward and recognize and reinforce what you want to see repeated in the future.
Something else that's really important, Brian, is to schedule unbroken periods of time with children, just time that you're there for them. And I think an important part of that is almost selfish, and that is not only so children see our commitment to them, but also so we get a chance to appreciate a lot of the attributes of childhood, Brian. You know, it's been said that childhood is our second chance. And I believe that a real key for parents is to learn more about their child, to learn more about childhood, so that they can learn more about themselves and, I think, have more joy. I think a real part of childhood is so that we can have more joy.
So just scheduling 10 minutes of time each day with each child is enough to keep their emotional tanks topped up, and then to schedule extended periods of time on weekends, vacations, and holidays to go for walks and to play and to go for movies is very, very important. In addition to scheduling unbroken periods of time, another thing that parents need to do is they need to express physical affection to their children. They need to hug their children. They need to kiss their children. They need to put their arms around their children. They need to tousle their children's hair.
And not just when they're young, or when they're older too. So many children say to me, my father stopped touching me at age 12. I mean, they know the day when they were pretty much cut off of this emotional playing, this physical touching and so on.
And it's amazing how important hugs are. There's lots of research that suggests that children need 4 hugs a day for survival and 8 hugs a day for maintenance and something like 12 hugs a day for growth. I met a wonderful woman at one of my seminars, and she gave me her card, and on her card had the word Mother Huggers. And she had formed a group called the Mother Huggers, and what they were was older women who went around to hospitals, especially senior citizens' homes, and they hugged the patients and the senior citizens in these homes. And that's all they did. They would just go and take them in their arms, and they would hug them for a little while, just hold them for a few seconds or maybe a couple of minutes. And it got to the point when they would make their weekly cycles to go to these homes, they'd all be waiting for them at the doors to be hugged. And there's a definite relationship between mental health, between a sense of safety, security, and self-esteem, and the number of genuine hugs that a person gets.
It's also a very close correlation between physical wellness, too. We know that infants who are not touched and held can actually die. And we know that older people if they don't have a pet or if they don't have close connections with people, also lose their will to live. So touching is a very important one. I believe it was Virginia Satir who said, you know, we need 4 hugs for maintenance and 8 for growth and 12 for loving and so on.
Yes, terribly, terribly important. Another is, and this is so important too, is when you overreact, and heaven knows you're tired, you're irritable, you've had a tough day, you've had a lot of problems, you come home, the television is on too loud, the children are fighting, there's stuff all over the place, the bicycle is in the driveway. Every so often, a parent will have the tendency to raise their voice and perhaps become just a little cross or overly expressive. But when you do that, which is normal and natural, be sure to go and take it back. When you shout at your child or you punish your child or you get cross or irritable, keep asking yourself, what's important here? And what's important here is the emotional integrity of the child, is that the child feels okay when he or she is around you. So if you have overreacted, go to the child as soon as you've calmed down and have the courage and have the character to take it back and say, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have shouted at you like that. Even if the child has done something that 100% deserved you to say or act or do something, nonetheless, what's important here is that you go and you take back this burden of criticism or this angry comment and you say, I'm sorry. You hug the child. And what I do with my children, even though my children are 2 and 3 years old, I would say, do you forgive me? And they will always forgive you. And at the instant that they forgive you, they melt, and all of the recrimination that's built up disappears. So having the courage to say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have shouted, will you forgive me, works miracles in developing your children's character and personality.
Right, and it also sends the message, Brian, that you can revise, regroup, and go again. It also sets up for children a model that says, when I lose it, I can think about it, I can get back in charge, and I can go on effectively. And that's an important modeling process of how children learn how to manage their behavior and how they will, in turn, Brian, treat their children.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Children learn how to deal with adult situations by watching how their parents deal with situations. And children 10, 20, 30, 40 years later are still imitating their parents' patterns, for better or for worse.
This is why it's so difficult to break that dysfunctional family syndrome, because we all come back and act upon a very familiar pattern, and that is what we've seen in our childhood years.
Here's another tip for raising super kids, is help your kids with their homework. Help them with their homework. Take an interest. Get involved. Children only consider their schoolwork and their homework important if their parents continually emphasize it, talk about it, ask about it, and get involved in it.
And also a word to parents here is that if you feel that you can't help your child with homework, if by time you come home you're tired and it's beyond what you're capable of doing, or if the homework is beyond your level, that's not uncommon with today's new math methods, and many parents have not had the number of years of foreign languages and math that their children have. If you feel that you can't help your child, find alternatives that work, but do know that your child's homework is a very big part of his life, and when it's not done, when he does not have his homework done, the next day he's not prepared. And when children's homework is done, they experience more success in school the next day. And children need that school success because that is their world of work, and they need to experience success there.
Right. Another thing that you can do to raise super kids is to go for a family walk at least once a week. We try to go for a family walk at least 3 times a week, but you can even make this a ritual. Every Saturday afternoon or every Sunday afternoon after church or before dinner, go for a family walk where the family goes for a good solid 1 hour or 1.5 hour stroll. Drive to a park and walk around the park. Drive to a beach. Find even a series of blocks that it makes a large circle out from your house and comes back from the other direction. And just go for a walk and talk and be together.
And another part of that is to find the time to play together, whether it be movie time together or recreational sports, where as a family you have to go somewhere. I know that the Family Fitness Center is a very wonderful place for families to come together, play together, be fit together. Those kinds of activities, Brian, lend itself to family time and to families being fit together, emotionally fit and physically fit.
Yes, and taking them out to dinner. taking a child individually out to dinner or out to a movie, having a date with an older child. As soon as your child reaches about the age of 10, it's about the age where they can start to have dates with you, where you can set up well in advance, where you'll go out for the evening. And you don't have to stay out all night. You can go out at 6 and be back by 8 or 8:30. You can make having the homework done a precondition of going on the date. But children really, really enjoy being taken out and treated as adults, especially when they're young. It makes them feel more respected, makes them feel more mature. It makes them feel that they have higher standards to live up to.
Right, and of course you're setting some really excellent social skills for them too. And something else that's really important, Brian, here is to help children make, sustain, and keep friendships. Talk to them about their friends, why these individuals are friends, what's important about the friendship, what they contribute to the friendship, what the friends contribute to them. Talk with them about the importance of friends. And a measure of how well your child is doing in his friendships is how often your child invites others home, how many friends he'll invite. That home place is a real signal to other kids that what happens there is together. It's a hot spot.
And another thing with regard to that is make your house the kind of place that the kids want to come to. Welcome children. Talk to the children that your children bring home. Welcome them. Greet them. Make sure they're okay. Check on them. Give them cookies and milk and things like that. Make it so that your house is the house that the kids in the neighborhood want to play at. That, again, is a tremendous benefit for your children.
And also is a very social status kind of thing for children at school, Brian.
Yes.
And another area, Brian, is to feed children healthy, nutritious foods, to know that you're fueling that body for a win.
We can never forget that your children do become what they eat, and the foundation for health and energy and vitality and a feeling of well-being has to be that they eat well, that they eat lots of nutritious foods, and of course, that you keep the non-nutritious foods out of the house as much as possible.
And that's followed up, Brian, with enough sleep, adequate rest, and also physical activity.
One of the things that we do is we take our children occasionally to a nice restaurant where they have to act with beautiful table manners. And it's very hard on them. They almost burst when they have to do it. But we tell them well in advance that we're going to take you to a very nice place, and then we dress them up, and we tell them we want them to act as though they're dining with the Queen of England. And so our children really make an effort to do that. Now, they don't always do it well, but they refer back to that event or those events days, weeks, months later. They're still referring to the time they went to the restaurant, and they behaved as well as they behaved.
Something we do in our family, Brian, is when we shop as a family. And so when we read ingredients or labels, we'll include our children as a part of that, as opposed to having them just kind of roam around from aisle to aisle and enjoy it. We'll have them be an active part of what nutrition is so that they get some consciousness that what we're buying also contributes to health.
This is the critical role of the parent as teacher. We have been so separated from the educational process for so many years that many parents don't realize that perhaps their prime function, aside from giving love and support and encouragement, is to teach their children the skills they need. It goes back to what you said about relationships, is that children don't automatically learn about relationships just as adults don't. They need instruction. They need to be told what works and what doesn't work and what you need to do to be popular and what some of the things you need not to do. And the same with nutrition. They need to be educated. They need to be taught how to buy the correct foods. And the younger you teach them, the more open they are to accepting the information and the more influenced they will be by it.
And, of course, Brian, monitoring television viewing, and we talked about monitoring newspaper viewing, just monitoring the messages coming into children.
If you want to get lots of good family time, leave the television off till 9 p.m. every night and set your bedtime at 10, and then you'll only have an hour of television, and you'll be surprised. Even children who are addicted to television will soon forget about television if they can spend time playing with their parents. One of the things that they can do with their parents is they can play games. Get games from the toy stores, games that are age-appropriate. Get Monopoly and Scrabble and get Clue and play little card games like Old Maid. Children love to play games with their parents, and it gives them a chance to learn how to cooperate, to negotiate, to interact, to socialize, to take their turn. Again, it's a very important part of their training.
It really is. And, of course, Brian, to aim for happy family dinners every night.
Yeah, as often as possible, get together with the whole family and sit together and laugh and share stories and make that part of your family culture is family dinners, whether it's during the week or on the weekends or holidays, but make it so that your children look forward to sitting down with the whole family.
That's right. It's a joyful time. It's a fun time. It's a time that they equate with togetherness and family cohesiveness, and not a time for what's wrong or what isn't working, but a time of joy.
And I think in our final recommendation on how to raise super kids is be sure to send them off to bed smiling every night. Make sure that the last thing that happens in their day is something that makes them feel good about themselves. If they've had a bad day, or if you've had an argument with them, or you've had difficulties earlier in the evening, be sure that you go to them, sit with them, talk to them, hold them, kiss them, tell them you love them, so they go off to bed to sweet dreams. They go off to bed feeling good about themselves. And if they go off to bed feeling good about themselves, they will wake up feeling good about themselves.
Brian, we've been talking throughout this whole program about how to help children feel happy and healthy, of course, but also self-confident. I think that what we've been saying throughout this program is that the emphasis is really on ourselves, that it really comes back to us thinking about the attitudes that we need to have to instill in our children being happy and healthy and self-confident. That while we want our children to achieve and to excel and to be the winners we want them to be, really begins with us. It really begins with a focus that that's our goal, and that there are some attitudes on our part that have to first be in place before our children can do that.
Yes, and if those parents listening will realize that parenting is a very inexact science, that it's a process of trial and error, that nobody ever gets perfect at it, that we always make mistakes, that we stumble forward a few steps and we fall back a step. But if you keep at it and you keep on keeping on, you can become an excellent parent. You can be the parent that your children need. You can raise happy, healthy, self-confident young people. And I'm Brian Tracy, and I wish you the very best.
And I'm Betty Youngs, and I wish you the very, very best.
For more information on how to contact Betty or Brian, or for more information on other resources developed by the authors, please refer to the back cover of this album.